Okay, welcome. This is advanced automation using Windows PowerShell. Actually, it's mostly going to be advanced PowerShell. So we're going to show you a lot of tips, a lot of techniques. This is primarily going to be a version 2 talk, but we wanted to talk about version 3 a lot.
Shaking.
How are we doing now? Turn them off? Oh, us. Turn them off.
Are we back on?
Is there a PowerShell command for that?
Yeah.
Reset.
Testing. Yes.
Hello, testing, 1, 2, 3, testing, howdy, okay, wow, well that's a little bit of excitement, got you woken up after a nice night of partying last night. So again, this is going to be, we wanted to talk about PowerShell version 3, because there's some exciting, crazy exciting stuff there, and they said, no, this is, you know, this conference is very much of a learn-do conference, and so PowerShell version 3 is not going to be out until Windows Server 2012 ships. Yes. So focus most of your content on version 2. And so what we decided was, okay, well, we're going to show you some of our most favorite and least favorite parts of PowerShell version 2, and then show how those transform or get addressed in PowerShell version 3. So we're being a little bit sneaky here. Now, this is going to be a lot of code. I mean, there's like a couple slides, and I think we're going to blow through those slides. This is primarily going to be demo, and code. So if you're just coming in, it's important to read this slide, right?
Was anybody here 15 minutes early and watched Jeffrey flounder with PowerPoint?
Yeah, so this is going to be a technical talk. So it'll be pretty chewy. We're going to try and explain this so that you can get it, but there'll be parts that you might not. So we're going to talk about PowerShell version 2, go into some advanced topics around the language, advanced functions, modules, remoting, jobs, and then give you a sneak preview of the V3 stuff. Okay, so PowerShell version 2, boy, there's just a ton of stuff that we put in there. These are some of the high-level features, right? Remoting, obviously one of the key things. PowerShell ISE, the goal there was to be better than Notepad, etc. So lots of great stuff. So let's get right into the demos. I told you, we're not messing around. So the first thing I want to do is to show you one of my least favorite things about PowerShell. And by the way, so I should ask, how many people use PowerShell? How many people are learning PowerShell? Okay, you guys might be in...
Okay. Have fun.
Yeah. Just put your seatbelts on. No, okay, so anybody who's learned it or is going to learn it, you're going to come across something that we knew early on in the language. We didn't like it, but we didn't know how to address it. And that's this issue of cardinality. Big word. What's that mean? That means sometimes when you execute a command, like get process, it returns one thing, and sometimes it returns many things. Okay, and it produces the following gotcha. So here we've got this command called get ID. And it takes in a name, and it gets the process for that name and returns the ID. Yeah, pretty simple stuff. So I say get ID minus name, LSASS, and it gives me the ID. Happy, happy, right? Yeah? But then what happens if I say *SS? Any guesses? Unhappiness ensues, right? I get nothing. And why did I get nothing? And the answer is because this then returned an array, okay? And so the ID does not have an array. And so when it's multiple things, what I have to do is to say, oh, I want the first one's ID. And now when I do that, okay, and now when I do this, I get the ID of the first one. Okay? So you have this cardinality issue. And so the way you address that cardinality issue in this version is you always, whenever you sometimes might get one and sometimes might get many, you always treat it as many. And the way you treat it as many is with the ampersand. And what that does is it casts anything to an array. If it's an already an array, it casts it to an array.
It was real obvious too, right?
It's very obvious. And so now I can do this, and it returns an array, happiness. And if I provide a singleton, that at operator casts anything that anything into an array. So you can always use this notational context. So two things. One, this is one of my least favorite things of the language. Sets us up for the PowerShell v3 discussion later on. And two, it's an important thing to have in focus. If you have not already, if you're learning PowerShell, you're going to run into this. Okay, so that's part of it. And then next, we switch to my machine. Okay, next I want to talk about hash tables. Okay, so this is the syntax for hash table. There, I just showed you ampersand parentheses. When it's ampersand squiggle brackets, that's a hash table. Okay, so here I say $hash equals hash of a equals 1, b equals, etc. Okay, I run that, and then notice this. Have you ever noticed this? So I said a, b, c, but then when I get the values, it gives me c, b, a. It's like, what are you doing? And the answer is, it's a hash table. And in .NET, hash tables have no order. Again, one of sort of my least favorite things, a lot of people's least favorite things, but that's okay, it's a hash table. Hash tables are awesome, and if you're learning PowerShell, you really want to spend some time playing with hash tables, because we're going to use them over and over and over again. So one of the things you might not know about hash tables is you can do hash table math. So this is a hash table, that's a hash table, and that's a hash table. And look, I can do addition. So now I go and I take the original hash table and I add two other hash tables to it, and the combination is a hash table, again, with wacky order. Okay? So very powerful stuff. Now, why do we care about hash tables? And the answer is we introduced this cool new thing. How many people have played with splatting? Yeah, okay. One of my favorite words in the language, splatting. Okay? So what is splatting? And splatting is a way to... let's do splatting right now. Here is the problem we'll show you, and then we'll talk about splatting. So I'm going to write us... We have the... In PowerShell version 2, we have the send mail message command, and you have to specify the SMTP server. You have to say who it's from, who it's to... and et cetera. Now, when I ever use that thing, I'm always using the same SMTP server, and it's always coming from me, right? So whenever I use this command, I don't want to type those parameters in over and over again. I mean, why would I? It's always me. I'm never sending mail from Travis. It's always sending it from me.
Try it sometime.
I could. People might read it. And so what you do is a lot of us go and we put a proxy function in front of it. And here's what I've done is I've made something, a function that send my mail message. It takes a to, a subject, and a body. And what I've done is now I've just hardwired those values, and then I provide -2, -subject, -body. Okay? So that does is... Now I've got that command, yeah, and I can execute this. And notice, so I'm sending it to myself, but notice I did not have to specify from, again, because it's always me, and I didn't have to specify the SMTP server, right? Because honestly, I can never remember that stuff. So having it in a function is great. So that's great, but notice this code, right? To subject, subject, body, body, blah, 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 blah. This is where splatting comes in. When we bind, when you run a script and you declare parameters, we bind all the parameters to a hash table called $ps bound parameters. Yeah? Makes sense once you hear it. So let's see how you do that. And now you can use that with splatting. So here, looks exactly the same, send my mail message, takes a to, a subject, and a body, calls send mail message, has the SMTP server, has the from, But then look, it doesn't have that to subject body. It just says ampersand PS bound parameters. And this is what is called splatting. Splatting says, hey, you can provide a hash table using the ampersand value here, ampersand in the name of hash table, and we will treat that hash table as though it were properties and values. Okay, so we just squirt it in there. And so you can see this is much easier to write. I didn't have to do the from, to, blah, blah, blah. Okay, so let's show you how that works. So we define it, and then much easier. And voila, that just works. Okay, so pretty good, except show command. Oh, I'm showing you some V3 stuff. Send my mail message. Well, here, you know what? We'll just do send command, show command, and we'll say mail message. Notice now, this is show command, version 3. It's great for finding commands, and it's great for exploring commands, okay? So here, there's this my send mail message, and look, it's got body subject 2, great. By the way, you can fill in the values here and then run it down here. But look at send mail message. Boy, there's a whole bunch that I didn't do, right? I forgot about priority, I forgot about attachments, I forgot about credentials, blah, 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 blah. And so if I wanted to, I'd actually have to go back and enter all that stuff as declarative parameters and then call this splatting again. You know, once that last line will be easy, but there's all that stuff in front of it. So that's where metaprogramming comes in. This is the real way to do it. Okay? So here we get the command send mail message. Oh, sorry. I need a light here. And then there's something called command metadata, and you pass it the implementing type for the command. Pretty chewy stuff. Here's what you really do. You're going to find this. It's out there on the web somewhere, and you just copy and paste it. But here's what happens. You have this metadata, and it tells you everything about the command. By the way, notice the IntelliSense? Ooh. Okay? So it tells you everything about the command, including, you know, what the parameters are, etc. And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to go and I'm going to remove the two parameters that I care about that I want to hardwire, the from and the SMT server, and then I output them. Okay, I use this to then create a proxy command, and I'm going to put it in a file, and here's where I do my Julia Child trick, and I don't actually do it, but I bring up the file. We will, using those simple commands, we generate the proxy for you. And here's what we generate. Notice it's got the to, the subject, all the correct attributions to it, blah, 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 blah. And then we come in here, and here's where we call it. We find the send mail message, and we call it a wrapped command. And notice it takes splatting. Okay, why are we talking about the splatting stuff? We use splatting a lot. Splatting is a very powerful technique. And so what I did was, that's what it came through, and then what I did was I just hardwired these two values. Okay, so it's very simple to do now. And I just go, and now we have splatting done right. Never mind. Oh, got to be in the right directory. We didn't fix that in version 3. And voila, that's splatting. Okay?
How did they come up with the name splatting?
I think it's historical. I think another command. You know, Bruce Payette is a walking encyclopedia of language, and he just knows all these languages. So I'm sure some like esoteric language like Erlang uses it.
Exactly. It's fun to say anyway. So
it is. Okay. So that was some advanced language features. Remember this warning. Okay. So with that, now we go to Travis is going to show us about jobs.
Yep. Does anybody here already use PowerShell jobs? A couple? Awesome. Jobs are one of my favorite things, and we did a ton of stuff in V3 with them, but let's look at V2 first. And so again, I'm imagining a lot of people here also use WMI as well. Yeah, it's a system center. Woo! So you might have run a command like this where I'm going to go look for all things, all classes that have ACC in them, and I'm going to recurse through the root namespace. And then, you know, that moment right before you hit enter, you find yourself wondering, just how long do I really have before this thing comes back? You know, it's like maybe I'll go get a cup of coffee, or maybe you've got time to head on down to Delmonico for a steak and a nap and come back after. And so one of the great things about PowerShell is, of course, we have jobs. And jobs allow you to run commands asynchronously in the background. So you get your prompt back. You can continue working. You could eat a steak if you wanted, I guess. But you can continue working, and the job runs in the background. So I specify this dash as job parameter to the command. And when I run it, I get back this thing that's a WMI job. And of course, see, I can continue typing. And we see that the state of this job is running. So it's just running off happily in the background for me. Let's take a look at some of the things that we can do with these job objects. So we can get jobs, which will just enumerate all the jobs that are currently on the system, whether they're running or not. I can receive them, which is how I go and get the results back from a job. And I can receive the results either while it's running or once it's completed. And of course, I can remove, resume, start, stop, just all the basic actions you can do with jobs. So if I type get job again.
By the way, just to be clear, you notice he said it was a WMI job. Jobs is a general concept in PowerShell, and then we have specific types of jobs. WMI jobs, later workflow jobs, all sorts of different types of jobs. The particular type of job responds to, may implement all these commands, and may implement a subset.
Yeah, okay? Yeah. And actually, so I guess I kind of let some of the cat out of the bag. We see some other jobs, some scheduled jobs. Yeah, woo. So my WMI job, we see that it's actually completed. So I can take a look at receive job and the name of it, which was job 2, because I didn't give it a better name. And I got back the output of that get WMI object command. So again, that WMI object, get WMI object command took a long time to run. I didn't really care. I came back and got the results.
Oh, you know what's cool, though? Can I try?
Yeah.
So notice if you do receive job again, right, it's gone.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so now check this out. We're going to run this thing, okay, and now we say receive job, job 10. 10?
Yep.
10. Okay, and, okay,
oh,
do that.
Again.
But now watch this. So anyway, if I do it again, it happened too quickly. Okay, so let's try it again. Now it's 12. 12. There's something called keep. So this might take a while, and you might want to go and examine, well, where are we, how far do we get, et cetera. But I don't want to get the results. I don't want to remove the results. I want to see the results, but I don't want to remove them. I want to keep the results. So that says, oh, here are the results up to where we are. And you can run it again and again and again until it finally completes. And then you can say, oh, great, I want them all. You get them all.
Yeah. And I assure you that while you're learning and working with jobs for the first time, that you will screw that up and you'll lose the results and you'll run it again. We've all done it.
Yes.
And it's just something, it's a rite of passage, I guess. jobs aren't just limited to WMI object, the WMI commands. Of course, you can run any PowerShell command as a job. So we ship this start job commandlet that allows you to take any long-running command or script and run it in the background. So if I had something real contrived like sleep 5 and get process, this is, you probably don't do this, but you might have something that takes, you know, 5-6 seconds to run. You can wrap that command inside of a script block on the start job command. So you say start job script block. Wrap everything in those little curly braces. And now that happens to just go and take off and run in the background, and I got my console again. And similar vein, I can say, hey, receive job 14, and get back those results. So any PowerShell command or script can actually be run asynchronously in the background as a job. And what's really cool is actually, so we'll show remoting in a bit, but there's something about remoting in jobs that is so cool that we'll show right now. So ignore one of the commands we're going to type, but you can run jobs against multiple machines. So imagine you're going to do a deployment and you want to target, you know, 10, 15 machines. You can run all those commands asynchronously against those machines as a job. So let's say I use this invoke command. This is the ignore evoke command. We'll talk about it more after. I'll say run it against some machines. All happen to be variations of this one.
Need a space.
What's that?
Sleep space 5.
Oh, thank you.
Sleep 5, yes. Sounds like deep space 5.
We should have called it that though, yeah.
Yeah.
And so again, the invoke command also has an as job parameter. And so I can run that, and now I see that, hey, the location, it's running on all those different places, and it's running, and this time it's a remote job, so just yet again another type of job for you. But if we say, let's take a look at the properties on here.
Oh, yeah, this is cool.
Yeah.
This is crazy cool.
So I can take a look, and there's some basic stuff. It's the state, it's completed, you saw all the machines it was running on. You can see the command that was actually running. There's some interesting stuff here, what time it actually started and what time it finished. It took, you know, what, 9 seconds, and output and all this. But right here, this field, child jobs, is what's interesting, is I can say j.childjobs, and I see that for each of the remote machines that I was running this job on, I actually have a separate job object back. So I could do something like, hey, let's take a look at the output of that from one particular machine, job 17. Maybe it failed and I want to go take a look at that. Or if we go back, get child jobs, I can see again. So this one, I already received the data and the other ones have data that are there. So you can take a look at all of the child jobs as they're running on the individual machines or look at them entirely. If I were to go and do receive job on
$J.
If I looked at them in their entirety, they actually get marked up with this computer name parameter, so I actually see where that output was from. So you might run against a bunch of machines, you're looking at the output, and you can actually tell where that was run.
Yeah, this is pretty powerful stuff. And it also explains why, if you've used jobs in the past, you'll notice you run a job, and it'll be job ID 1. And then you run another job, and it'll be job ID 3. And you're like, what happened to 2? And the answer is all jobs have child jobs. Mm-hmm. And so that's what's happening. The parent job was job 1, and the child job was job 2. And that allows you to have this smooth programmatic function. And in fact, you can even do, he showed where you can go in, and you know, I have a job object, and it has a bunch of child job objects, and you can receive the input. You can also treat them as individuals. You can say, stop this one. You know, resume this one, suspend, etc. And if you do it at the parent, it does it to all the children. Mm-hmm. So very nice design.
And of course, when you're done with a couple of them, you say get job 16, pipe to a remove job, and you can just clean up. You know, we got rid of 16, so I could do that for all the others. But I actually need some of those for later, so I'm not going to get rid of them all. Oh, that's jobs.
All right. Jobs. Okay, now I get to show you advanced functions. All right. So this is a function. Okay, function, you give it a verb down name. You can optionally define parameters, and here I'll have two, computer and user. And I just have a simple action. I'm going to write the output to, you know, computer and user. Okay, so pretty simple stuff. Here I define it. And now I'm going to show you show command we're going to explore it. So show command shows you the name and that it has two parameters, computer name and user. Okay? And if I want to, I can type that C1, U1, and I can run it. Okay, pretty simple stuff. But now what I'm going to do is I'm going to add a parameter statement. Okay, so this is a parameter attribute, and you can put it on something. At this point, it's doing not much other than making this from an informal function to a proper commandlet. Okay, and so what is a proper commandlet? And the answer is, here, we do this again, we'll define it and show it. And now I have this, computer. But notice now I have these common parameters. Common parameters are what separate a proper commandlet from an informal function. These common parameters are debug, error action, error variable, output, etc. And so here I'll say, hey, let's give the output variable to be X. And when I run it, okay, it ran that, and, oops, $X, it put the output there. Okay, so when you declare, when you put that parameter attribute in it, you turn it into a commandlet. Being a commandlet says, hey, you provided a little bit of code, and PowerShell Engine provides a bunch of functionality around that for the user. So it's very powerful with a single statement. But once you're there with parameter, now you can do things like, hey, I'd like to make this mandatory. Well, here, I'll just say. Say mandatory equals 1. So now, let me do this again. Okay, notice the star. Okay? And so now if I just try and notice that run is disabled, I can provide a user value for here, but it's still not enabled because this is mandatory. And as soon as I provide that, then I can run it. Okay? So now all of a sudden you see how as you start to incrementally define attributes, then PowerShell interprets those attributes and provides more and more functions for you. And there's a ton of these things, and again, this is really the way you do it. You just start looking at them one by one, exploring, and there's a ton of great stuff there.
We should show them snippets.
Ooh, I should show you snippets. Yeah. Well, that's version 3. When we get to...
Your okay. Show.
Okay. Yeah. Well, okay. So version 3...
What?
You'll have this wonderful thing called snippets, right? So have you ever sat there and you say, oh, I want to write a proper function... What was that syntax again? Or for me, I don't know what it is. I just have this sort of mental block. I always forget the syntax for a switch statement. You know, I don't know why, I just do. And so now, if you type Control J, we have snippets. Okay? And so for me, I run down here, find the switch statement, and it puts in a snippet of code that I then go and expand upon. Alternatively, you can go and say, hey, we've got advanced functions, and complete advanced functions. So yes. I do a complete one, and notice what it does. I mean, it's pretty. It shows you the help, you know, the commandlet help, you know, the comment-based help, and all the values. Sets this up, gives a commandlet binding, the output type, parameters. You know, lots of examples for things you can then cut and paste from.
So you can go to sleep now because everything that Jeffrey will show you, you can just go grab.
Exactly. That's true. Thanks. Okay, so now we'll go here and say, hey, I'm going to make these things, I'm going to have different parameter sets. Okay, so what's a parameter set? And the answer is, imagine that I say, this function can work against a computer or a user. It's one or the other. That's what's called a parameter set. Like with, you know, you're familiar with the net commands, right? Net use versus net share. Those are two different, you're still using the net command, but if you provide one set of parameters, it does one function. If you provide a different set of parameters, it does a different function. That's called a parameter set. And here's how you do that. So both of these things are mandatory, and they've defined two different parameter sets. And so when I run that, notice the parameter sets show up here as tabs. So here's the parameter set here, and the parameter set for user. So that's what a parameter set is. Okay. Next, you can do a bunch of validation stuff. Oh, sorry, here. Here, what I've done is I've declared a parameter, I said it's mandatory, and then I've provided a help message for this thing. Okay? And then I've also provided an alias. So computer name could be CN, machine name, server, PS alias. And so now, instead of show command, I'm going to show you get help. Okay? So it shows that. I can say get help minus parameter computer. Look, gives me the information, right, that it's mandatory, and here are all the aliases. Okay, so what that means is I can do things like, I could have said, hey, I want to run this test help automation minus computer, C1 minus user, U1. That works. Or I could have said CN. That works. Or what was the other one? Server name? --, server. Yeah? Any of those aliases work. Okay? And this is very useful when we have very strong guidelines. Use this word, not that word. And you're like, well, okay, but I want to do that, but everyone's used to this other word, or I've got a local community that's used to this other word. The answer is use the proper word and then use aliases to map to whatever else you want to do. Okay? Now the other benefit of this is that these attributes can save you a ton of programming. Okay? So you can do things like and deliver a much better user experience. So now what I'm going to do is I'm going to go and I'm going to say, hey, this value, this parameter, can only have 3 possible values. Okay? And so now when I run this and I try and do that command I did before, it's going to come back and say, nope, you know, the parameter for computer does not is not one of these values. So it produces an error. You didn't have to do that check. We did that check. And what's even cooler is when you do show command, we'll show it as a drop-down box. Okay? So this is there's lots of fun stuff to play with advanced functions. Again, the basic concept is this. You write your functionality. You add a little bit of annotation to it to tell us how to add extra value, extra functions to your commandlet. And this is how you're able to get production-oriented commandlets very, very easily. So that's the model, right? We talk about this a lot. We always talk about, hey, you start off, you write something quick and dirty, get the job done, and then as you, like, that was for me, but now I'm going to share it with you, so I got to make it a little bit more formal because I don't want to embarrass myself. And then, you found it useful, and you said, hey, why don't you share it with everybody? Everyone loved that thing. And I was like, oh, I don't want to throw it away and start from scratch. I want it to be formal for everyone. And so what you do is you just go in and you start adding these things. Oh, here's some validation, here's some help, et cetera. And we do all that hard work for you. So that's the deal with advanced.
Yeah. And you can always, yes, ISE snippets. That's my favorite snippet, that advanced command, the full one. Because it's absolutely everything. It's disgusting.
It is. And it's useful for me because I always forget also the comment-based help. Mm-hmm. Like I always forget what the keywords are.
Yeah. So download PowerShell 3.0.
When you get this age, you'll forget that stuff too. Okay, so now, yes, grasshopper. When you can grab the mouse from my hand, you are prepared to leave. Okay, now we're going to talk about modules. How many people are using modules? Okay,
all right.
Great. The rest of you all should be using modules. And you can. We're going to prove it. Everyone's capable.
Let's hit the other button there.
The other.
It's advanced technology up here. There's buttons and lights on it. So what I have on the screen here is actually just a very simple counter implemented in a script file. So it's a .ps1 file, and it's a very contrived example as well. And basically it has a variable for a counter and an increment. So we start at 0, and we'll increment by the increment each time.
Apparently we have 75 minutes left.
Okay.
This is going to be infinite.
It's the longest session ever. I lost my track there. No, so then I have a function for update count, which will go and add the increment to our counter, this function here. Then I have a function for resetting the count that will set the count back to 0 and the increment back to 1. And I've got this little helper function called setIncrement that will allow me to change how much the update count actually affects the counter. So pretty basic script, and I'm going to show you. So in the past, what you would do with this is you would go and you would bring this into your session through dot sourcing. So you'd say, bring in counter.ps1. Let me make this bigger. And so now that I have dot source counter.ps1, all of those things are available for me. So I can say, you know, update count. I can say set increment. Yikes. To 100, and now update count will go up to by 100 each time. And then if I also go and look at the variables, I've brought in the count and increment variables. And those are the problem here, of course, with scripts is that, you know, if you're sharing scripts amongst yourself, PowerShell is a very vibrant and active community. So, you know, Jeffrey sent me a script, and he's got a count and increment variable. I put it in my environment. Happened to be that I also had a count and increment variable. Well, splat. I mean, there goes my count and increment. His script is going to go and overwrite mine.
That's, I'm not the, even... that's the bad kind of splat.
Yeah, that's the bad splat. And so I don't even get an error or a warning or anything that this happened, so my scripts are probably not going to behave the way they did before, and I have no clue why. Right?
Yeah.
So my environment is now basically it's polluted, and there's no way I can even get rid of them. So what's nice is that if you guys all know how to write scripts, then you all know how to write modules, and I'm going to show you. And just put your seatbelts on, though, because this is going to be advanced. We said this is the advanced session, right? So if I wanted to write a module from my counter script, I press the left arrow key, and I hit the M key.
How many people can find the M key? Yeah? You can write a module, too.
Yes. And voila, I have written a module. So I actually need to get a new PowerShell session open because, well, like I said, I've polluted my environment with count and increment now, but... and so before, what you'd do is you dot source that script to bring it into your environment. But with modules, what you do is you actually call an import module command. So I'll say import module counter.psm1. And now when I take a look at those commands, they're here, and they work just the same way that they did before, right? Everything works just the same way. But if I go and take a look at the variables, I'll see that those count and increment variables aren't there. So they haven't come and polluted my environment. By default, with modules, what we do is we'll export all of the functions that are in the PSM1 file. We'll export all of the aliases that are defined in there. But we'll leave things like the variables out. Now, of course, they're there. They're in a sort of their own isolated little environment that all of your module code will run in. But they're not going to go and pollute your actual calling environment here. In the module? Let's find out.
If you change it to global.
If I change it to global, it'll come. Well, we're going to find out.
Yeah, it will.
It will. All right.
It subverts the module.
But not if you keep it as script scope.
Correct. Script is in the module scope. By the way, so this is advanced. You want to see something truly freakishly advanced?
Like,
yeah, okay? Okay. Put your seatbelts on. I think this works. You're never going to do this, but it's really fun. So the module was, let's see.
It was counter. Dot.
Was it get module? What was the name of it?
Counter.
Counter?
Yeah.
Okay. So we can say $M equals this. And if memory serves me right, again, I don't do this a lot because it's a little esoteric, but Bruce Payette, I told you about Bruce, right? The encyclopedia. Guy, check this out. Ampersand is the execute operator, right? Because that's how you say ampersand notepad, right? That executes the string notepad. And I think you can do the, what did you do here? You tried to do, where do you got your error?
By looking at the variables.
Variables.
Yeah.
So you put that in the squiggle brackets and you say ampersand $M. So with that $M was the module, and so what you do is you say ampersand execute in the module scope $M and the squiggle bracket that command. Those variables exist. They exist in the module scope, and so you're able to execute commands in the module scope. Is that freakish or what? You're never going to use it.
He likes
but
it, yes.
It's so cool. You could just like freak out your friends. Oh, yeah, you know. What, you don't know that? Oh, I guess you don't really know PowerShell then.
Wow.
Did you know that?
I actually didn't.
Well, Grasshopper, you were not prepared.
I'm ready to go.
You were not prepared to take the mouse from my hand.
Anybody want a mouse? He'll be in a ton of trouble.
I guess it should be PowerShell, right? So you're not prepared to take the keyboard from... I think it'd be pretty easy to snatch the keyboard from my hand.
Yeah.
Sorry.
I don't know. I just got a cable. I can't run away, so... back to the show at hand here. With our module, so by default, of course, I said that variables are not exported into the global session, and the functions and aliases were. But what if I actually wanted to go and tweak some of the functions? So setIncrement was a helper function here in my module. I wanted it for code that was in my module, but I don't want to actually expose it out to users to use. So I have this. This was my script module. And I tweaked it by adding just this one command, this export module member command. And I say, hey, export only things that are star dash count. And so now when we look at the code, the only things that get exported from this module are going to be update count, reset count, and of course set increment won't be exported because it doesn't match that expression. So let's take a look. Actually, while I'm here, to understand which modules that you have imported already, you run the get module command, and it shows you, hey, here are the handful of things that are available. If you're wondering which commands are actually in a module, you can say get command module, and so I can run that against our counter module, and we see that was my old counter module. The three functions were exported, and similarly, I can go and remove that counter module by saying remove module.
Yeah, and that's the one huge benefit, one of the many huge benefits of modules is when you remove it, it's a nice cleanup. We just clean up all that stuff. No silt hanging about.
Or, you know, as you just saw, I had to actually open up a new PowerShell instance because my other one was basically corrupt. So now I don't have to worry about it. All of that stuff is actually gone. And so if I want to import that new module, this import module counter one, that was the one that I just added that export module member command to. And I bring that in. If I take a look at the commands that are available from the counter one module, well, you see, of course, it's set increment. My helper function that I needed access to has not been exported, so users don't see it. So you can write all of the stuff in your module in that PSM1 file and then choose just the few things that you export to your users. So that was a script module. And of course, not all modules have to be scripts. We support binary modules as well. Does everybody remember snap-ins from PowerShell 1.0? And they're a little bit of a pain. You had to be an admin to install them. There were assemblies. You had to write managed code. It's ugly. Anyway, so with modules, we can actually treat all snap-ins, all PS1 snap-ins, just like modules. And as an example, I'll show you the Windows Automation snap-in. It's a project from the CodePlex. Some of you may have used it.
Again, the key point of this is that in the past, to have a snap-in, you had to be an admin to be able to register it and then import it. And here, now you don't. Just X-copy a DLL and then say
import module. Wow. So, and with that Windows Automation snap-in, again, like Jeffrey said, you had to be an admin, and when you downloaded it, it was a DLL, and it came with a couple scripts, and you looked at it, and you go, oh, man, I'm glad somebody else wrote that at least. Find install util, and there was an analogous uninstall, so that was ugly. But we don't actually need any of that anymore, since the snap-in was already compiled. It's a binary. The DLL's here on my disk. I only needed the rights to just copy it to my disk. I can say import module, Windows Automation. Where am I here?
I have no idea.
All right. Yes. Import module, Windows Automation.dll. And now that PS1, that snap-in from PowerShell version 1, has actually been imported into my session, and it's a module. And so I can say get module, and the Windows Automation snap-in has been loaded. I treat it as a module. Hooray! And I can remove it. And I could access all the commands. So, oh, I don't know if anybody saw that. We have tab completion in PS3 on things like modules, so you can actually... You don't have to remember what you imported.
Oh, even better. Cool. Right, even better. Ooh,
yeah.
IntelliSense. You go pick it. Not even just tab completion.
Yeah.
But we keeps hinting about version 3, which I want to get to.
Yeah, okay, so that's it for modules. So again, you can write them, they're easy, PSM1 file scripts, or any of your snap-ins, you can just call import module on them, and they get brought in.
So we're going to try and zoom to this through some of this stuff to get to the version 3. Now, let's see, how many people have remoting in focus? Okay, not as many as I wanted. Okay, fine, that's no problem. Remoting was a key feature in version 2. So you can always, you know, everywhere that you say host a command, like host name, yeah, that's really doing this, invoke command, and then squiggle brackets host name. Those two statements are the same thing. Okay. Now, the reason why host invoke command is interesting is because it's got a ton of stuff on it. By the way, these squiggle brackets, you can do anything you want into them, right? So you can say get, process, pipe to where, handles, handle count greater than 900. Okay, and that ran locally. And now you can go and you can say, hey, I'd like to run it on computer name. What's it doing that? Localhost. Okay, and so then, so wherever you run invoke command, you can say, you can specify a command, a computer name, and it will run that script block over there. And you can run it on one or multiples, et cetera. And what's really happening is that on that remote machine, there are a set of named endpoints that you can then squirt the code into and have it execute. Those endpoints have different configurations. And if you don't specify an endpoint or configuration name, we use the default one, okay? But underneath the covers, we're actually specifying a configuration name, okay? Now, when I do this, so by the way, so that I do that remotely, happiness, my computer name, but what we did was we created a connection, we fired up a process, we ran CLR, we initialized it, we fired up PowerShell, initialized it, all this initialization, then I ran the code, and then I threw it all away. And that's what happens when you type computer name. Alternatively, you can say, hey, I'm going to do that multiple things, so I'd like to have a new PowerShell session to that remote machine. I want to start a session, and I put in a variable, $s. And now I can specify that session that is part of the invoke command. And you notice when I did computer name, it took a while to return. Watch how fast this happens. Boom. Pretty darn quick. Okay. Now, what I did was I captured the output with this into a variable, P. OV stands for output variable. And so if I take a look at P, okay, shows me I have, it's the processes, but notice it has PS computer name on it. Okay. So we tag, when we bring this information back, we tag its origin. So you always kind of know where it came from. It helps you diagnose things. So what's the difference between the local object and the remote object? And so what I'll do is I'll say get process, pipe to get member, and I'll just take a look at some of these commands. Then you see it's a system diagnostics process, and I've got these commands and their types. And now what I'll do is I'll do the same thing, but instead of getting these live objects, I'll pass in the objects that I got from the remote system. Okay? Now notice the difference. Here, I got a system diagnostic. Following that, I got a system diagnostic process. Here, I got a deserialized system diagnostic process. So it looks very much like the same thing, but it isn't. It's different. Notice here, this is a type, strong type, priority boost enabled, and here it's just a Boolean. Here it's a rich class. Here it's not. And the reason for it, right? We deserialized it. And that this allows us to be able to manage anything. If I didn't do it this way, then we'd have to have all the classes of all the world running on your laptop, and none of us have laptops that are that big. It also then breaks as we version things. So that's the difference between those two. Now, I want to talk about these endpoints I mentioned, okay? And they're super powerful because they allow a lot of interesting things. So first what I'll do is I'll show you the configuration. Get PS session configuration. These are the ones that are there. That shows you what's available. And here are the ones that are there. Process PowerShell 32, PowerShell, and PowerShell workflow. That comes in version 3. But here I'm going to create a new one. I register PS session configuration, I give it a name, and I give it a startup script. And temp constrain me, and then I say show a security descriptor. So I execute this, tells me the security ramifications, and allows me, brings up a security editor. So now I'm going to add a user, which is a local user, and this user has no privileges. Okay, so it's just a sort of guest account. Come on back. Come on back.
You can do it.
There we go. Okay, so MSP user. Yeah? And you have to give it full control. Okay? So now I'm admin right now, and I've just enabled a new run space that this guest can use, this one particular guest can use. So here, as an admin, I can connect to that test endpoint. Yeah? Happiness. Now, I ran this startup script called constrain me, and what it did was it defined some functions, and then it defined what things were available, and then hid everything else. Okay? So when I connected to that, now when I run get command, you see there's a very limited set of things I can do. I can't do everything. Okay? And when I run get me, a function I just wrote, it shows me I'm connected as JSONover, and I run as JSONover. Okay? So that's interesting. And when I want to get a service, it just works. Okay? So at this point, I'm me, I connected, I have a constrained environment. Okay? But now I'm going to connect as a low privilege user. At first, I'm going to try and connect. This is a low privilege user, and he's going to try and connect to a normal endpoint, right? The default endpoint. It says, "Nope, can't do it. You don't have privilege." So that's okay. We set up an endpoint for this person. And he connects. And now when he sees the commands, see, he can't see everything. He can only do a limited set of things. And you see he comes in as MSP user, so he keeps his identity. But then when he tries to do a privileged action, he can't do it. Okay, so you constrain the environment, but still they only have the privileges that they have. Okay, and now we go ahead and remove that. So that's the notion of these run spaces, these configurations. You can set them up, and it's a name, an access control list, potentially a startup script. Okay, and you can have as many of these things as you want. And so the benefit of this is you can say, hey, I'm going to set up an environment where, like, I own the storage, and you need storage from me. And I'm like, I'm not giving you admin privs to my storage. I'm responsible for this. But what I'll do is I'll set up one of these endpoints. I'll give you admin privs for that, but I'm only going to allow you to perform these four functions. That's it.
And this, so the one that they connect to by default, though, if they don't specify it, it's called Microsoft.PowerShell. So when he said configuration name, what was it you called it, test, if he didn't specify that, of course, it tries to connect to one called Microsoft.PowerShell.
Exactly. And so this is all preparation for some wonderful stuff we've done in V3. It's great in V2, very powerful stuff. V3, just pour gasoline on the fire we created. Okay, so now we get to talk about V3. So had a lot of themes for V3, or kind of big three things. First, make it simple and easy. You know, find all the burrs in the environment, reduce those, simplify the steps. We have this new enhanced PowerShell ISE we've been showing you. We'll show you a little bit more. We have a simplified syntax for a lot of the language, makes it easier to learn. We have the auto module loading, which we're going to show you. And then these, again, always dealing with a messy world. We have commandlets for managing REST APIs, for accessing web things. We've improved the remoting. We've integrated workflow. Yes, we've taken the workflow, Windows workflow engine and PowerShell, and we've brought them together. Basically, we went out there and we saw everyone was doing it, and everyone was doing it differently. And so the workflows that you created for one environment, you couldn't use anywhere else. So we now have defined the definitive way to take these two technologies and put them together. We have job scheduling, and this might like integration with task scheduler, and this delegated administration, which I can't wait to show you. And then we always have this theme. The version we work on, we want to be a better version of the one we just shipped. So we take all the feedback from you, and we prioritize it, and we just fix it. We had somebody come to the booth the other day who's been using the beta and just said, man, you just fixed everything that had bugged me. So that made us feel good. Dozens of features. This is the release where we just really just poured gasoline on the fire. There's so much to it. It's actually a little bit of a problem in that it's hard to communicate and hard to talk about. So there'll be lots of blogs about that. And here's, you know, hundreds of commandlets. So the big thing was that in version 1, we shipped with 130 commandlets. In version 2, we shipped with 230 commandlets. And in Windows Server 2012, we're shipping with over 2,430 commandlets.
Yeah.
So remember, our goal was to give you a world where you could think about what you want to do, type it, and get it. Okay? And in version 2, there were 230 things that you could think, type, and get. And in this release, there's a ton more. So good stuff. So let's talk about PowerShell version 3.
Yeah, I want to actually stay there for 1 second. I want to show something about module auto-loading. So, because Jeffrey did mention that, hey, we shipped 2,400 commandlets. And that's a lot. Let me go here. So in PowerShell V2, if you were wanting to run commands that were packaged up into a module, you had to actually know where that module was. You'd say get module list, tells you which ones are available for you. And if I wanted to actually run any of the commands that are from that module, I had to then import them. So I could say, hey, import module bits transfer. And then now I could actually call the commands that are in the bits transfer module. If I tried to do it before, I got an error, and you couldn't actually run them. So that was PowerShell V2.
By the way, we got to pick up the pace.
Yeah. What's that?
We got
20 minutes? All right, we'll swim through this. So, of course, with 2,300 commandlets, we have a very large number of modules. Yeah, there you go. Proof is in the pudding. Wow.
The first time you run list, get module list available, it takes a bit of time. There's some reasons for it. You don't care. It just takes a bit of time. And then you see, do it the second time, it'll come back like that.
There we go. So there's actually over 100 modules. And so if we were to sit there and say, hey, you have to remember where each of the 2,430 some odd commandlets are packaged. Yes, you have to remember which of these 8 or so network-related ones contains the network commandlet that you're looking for. You'd probably come and find us and shoot us. And that would be acceptable, I guess. So with PowerShell, we have this thing called the PS module path. And it's just like the path variable on your actual operating system. It tells us where we can find modules. And so with PowerShell 3, we actually go and search through that module path, and we'll go and reflect on all of the modules there, and we build a cache of them. And so now when you enter any command, we'll take a look and say, hey, does any of the things in the module path contain that command? If so, import the module and run it. So you don't have to actually, we just abstracted the notion of having to know where that command was. So again, we want to think type get. I want to work with shares. Okay, there's get SMB share. And I'll hit enter. Now I didn't import a module here because module importing took care of it. Before it ran get SMB share, it actually loaded that SMB share module for me. And so that'll work for any module, whether we wrote it or somebody else, as long as it's in the PS module path.
Do you have more that PS module path? Do you define more than one path? Or?
Yeah, of course, just like a path variable, semicolon. Yeah. Yep. And you can see mine even had a couple there, so it was two locations there. So that's module autoloading. Love it. The next thing is actually remote module importing. Ooh, this one blew my mind the first time. So I just looked at the modules that are available on my current machine that I was able to load in and then actually call. But what if I wanted to manage a different machine and it has a module on it that I don't have on my machine? So I've got a file server. It might be a server core, but it has a module there. I want to go get the file server module from it and bring it down to my client and then run those commands. So I can do that with remote module autoloading. So I'll create a new session, and then I can say get module. We've added this new PS session parameter that takes that session, and it'll list all of the modules that are available on that machine. So again, this is my local machine, so we're looking at those. And I might say, hey, it was a storage module that I was really looking to work with. And now when I can pipe that to the import module commandlet that we already showed, and it's going out to that server, it's grabbing a copy of that module, it's generating proxy functions that wrap the commands that are in there with a little bit of goop to enable some remoting, and see, it's generating that. And now when I type get module, I have this storage module that's actually been imported. And when I run those commands, they're actually going to implicitly run against the machine that I got them from. So that's the part that blows your mind, is you're sitting there and you say, okay, you didn't have to type computer name anymore. Now whenever I run those commands, they're actually going to run against that other machine. This is another form of implicit remoting for anybody who is familiar with import PS session in PowerShell 2.
And the nice benefit of that is because you have all those commandlets locally on your client, you have IntelliSense, you have auto-completion, all that great stuff. And then when you execute it, it runs remotely. Yeah. You have discovery, all that wonderful stuff.
And the best part about that is that
show
the machine that I am pointing this at, it actually doesn't even need to have PowerShell installed on it. So if I, yeah, it doesn't have to have PowerShell. So if I had a Windows Server 2012 box that was deployed as server core, and I removed .NET and I removed PowerShell, so it's just a really, really small thing, and it had a module on there, a SIM-based module, we won't get into that. When I import that, those commands will actually run because it's all SIM-based. It'll run against that server that doesn't even have PowerShell on it.
Just so you understand what he's saying, is in version 3, how do we get such dramatic increase in coverage? And the answer is we've leveraged a way to write SIM commandlets, WMI. If you write WMI a particular way, then we'll auto-generate commandlets for you. And so what this means is all the kernel guys said, okay, I'm in, I'm totally in. Manage code, it's too high up in the stack for us. We deal down way low in the stack. WMI is perfect for us. So now there's a native code way to write commandlets.
Yeah.
There you go.
So that's the module improvements for V3. There's okay. Others, but there's more exciting stuff. Oh, you know what? Actually, wait. Before we jump to module improvements, maybe I'll show scheduling.
Go.
Sure. That's a tricky part. Well, while I was writing the demo, I was thinking, you know what? Oh, sorry. How do you tell if it's running against a remote machine? So you can tell from the module that it was a script module, and if you look at the command, it'll actually have the guts, but there was nothing that was really obvious right there. And so guess what I'm going to go do on Monday morning? Go talk to somebody if there's anything we can do in, well, maybe the next version.
You can use a prefix. So when you create that module, you can say, put a prefix in front of it, like R for remote. And so then instead of new SMB share, it'll be new R SMB share. That's what prefixing is for.
Yeah, but the prefix
you don't need
doesn't
to wait
work
on
the module.
Week.
Yeah, that's true, too. But it'll be on the commands only. Just by looking at the module, you won't see the prefix. So,
yeah.
Scheduling. We'll race through this one, I think. So I showed jobs earlier. And jobs are great if I was sitting there and I was actually there to run the job when I wanted it to run. But of course, we might have a one-time maintenance window we need to honor, or you might want to actually schedule something to run on a regular basis, say every week. So with PowerShell 3.0, we've introduced job scheduling. And so those commands for scheduling jobs all live in this module called PS Scheduled Job. And there's a handful of things in here. So working with job triggers, where triggers define when that job is actually going to run. There's scheduled job options that are some advanced things that from advanced configuration, like whether it has to be idle or machine network. And of course, the scheduled jobs themselves. So the triggers that are available, you can do it once, daily, weekly, startup, log on, all things that seem familiar to you for the from the Windows task scheduler. And if I wanted to go and say, hey, create a new daily trigger, the syntax is really, it's pretty natural feeling. It looks nice. And I could say, hey, a one-time trigger that will run in an hour. Or I might want to create a trigger that will fire a job off every Friday at 6 p.m. So let me actually go and schedule this. It's a scheduled job that's called the daily backup. And I'm going to use that daily trigger we just created. So it's going to run every day at 3 a.m. And it's just going to copy some files from my important files to somewhere else. Not in this build, but we would like to make that happen. or, of course, I could have done the weekly trigger. And through the get scheduled job command, you can see which ones are actually already on your machine. So I've got three, the daily backup, this energy analysis job that I've been running on my machine, and then the weekly report one we just created. And of course, I can take a look with the get job trigger commandlet. It shows me exactly when that thing is going to run.
Are there any other triggers other than just date time?
The at logon and at startup. So for at logon, you can specify all users or a particular user.
Hey, you know what? Can we hold the questions come up at the end? Because we got like 11 minutes and we got like that to do.
Okay.
So yeah, we'll answer the questions and we'll also be at the speaker Q&A tonight.
So one of the nice things actually about those scheduled jobs is that I didn't need to be there to get those results. So again, you probably ran those things when you weren't there. So if I create this new PowerShell session, I say, hey, get scheduled job. You see that those three things were there and those jobs are running whenever I wasn't there. Now if I type get job, we looked at that command earlier. It shows you the jobs, the scheduled jobs that ran. And I can say, hey, get job 5 FL star. And I can see the output, and I can actually see when it ran. So I can say, hey, this one ran a few weeks ago at 9 o'clock at night. And just the same way, I could actually do receive job 5. And I can actually get the output from that thing. So unlike people who have rigged up Task Scheduler to run their scripts, we're actually going to take care of keeping all the results for you, and you work with them just like you work with regular jobs.
That's sweet. Sweet, sweet, sweet. You want to party with that. There's lots of good stuff there. So now I'm going to zoom through some stuff. A bunch of stuff I showed you before, now I'm going to show you how they work in version 3. So remember we had the hash tables. Hash tables are great, except, hey, how come they don't preserve order? Because that's a hash table. We now have something called ordered. Ordered, you can create a hash table, and guess what? It's ordered. And the hash table math continues to work. But it's ordered, so good stuff there. Next, remember splatting, right? So the scenario was, hey, send mail message is 2, and the mail server are always the same. And so we use splatting. By the way, splatting is just a general principle. It's a great thing to know. But boy, that was a lot of work just to hardwire 2 variables. Wouldn't it be great if I could specify something like PS default parameter values, where I could have a hash table where the key was the name of the command and the parameter, and then the value was the value. And the answer is that's exactly what we've done. So here I've got PS dollar parameter values. I send, say, the commandlet colon and the value from to subject, etc. And now I do that, right? Even the body. And now when I do this, if I provide those commands, those parameters, I use them. If I don't, we use these default parameter values. Right? So now it's going to send me that mail message.
That's awesome.
Here, I override those, and anyone that I override, it uses my value. If I didn't override it, it uses the default values. This is crazy powerful stuff.
Particularly useful if you have, hey, a particular computer name you want to keep running things on.
That's
or if you have
Oh, sorry. So next, here, I got a credential. So sometimes you're dealing with remote machines and you want to use an alternate credential. So here, I get the credential.
You're not going to take my mouse back again, are you?
I am. Here, I reset this parameters. And I say, hey, all commands that take a computer name, I want to use this computer name. Any command that takes a credential, use these credentials. And anything that asks for authentication type, use negotiate. Now I use test of his man and uses all those values. So it works with wildcards as well. Very powerful stuff. In fact, so powerful. You want to be careful.
His head here. I think you hit a good spot.
Oh, good. Remember that cardinality, right? That pain in the butt cardinality? This get ID thing? So now, if I say, get ID, and notice it's not doing the index, right? So we know that that's going to work when I say minus name LSASS, right? And we also know it's going to fail when I say star SS, except it doesn't. So now we treat the dot operator as working for everything. Okay, so you give us an array, we give you that ID for each one of the elements. We give you an array back. Alternatively, you could have said, well, hey, I'd like to do this, right? And what we'll do is, okay. LSASS works, or star it works. Okay, so we've eliminated this seam between a singleton and an array. So wonderful stuff. You're going to love it, love it, love it, love it, love it. Okay, workflow. Okay, remember we had function and this function, right? And if you recall, let's show you again how this works. So this is a function and, where'd it go? Oh, no. Oh, okay. So yeah, so you saw that there wasn't a whole lot there, right? There weren't very many functions, many parameters, no common parameters. Now what I do is I just change this one word, workflow. And remember, what was the model? The model was you be informal and then incrementally change or add things, and then PowerShell brings a ton of function for you. And so what happens is now we have this and common parameters, and look what we have. As job, debug, error action, all the commandlet stuff, but then authentication, application name, authentication, authentication level, thumbprints, computer names, retries. There's a gazillion of these things, because what we do is we take that code and we turn it into a Windows workflow so that it can run against lots and lots of machines. So crazy powerful stuff there. And by the way, and it still just looks like a commandlet. Okay, so we've integrated workflow technology, but it looks just like a commandlet. This goes back to our sacred vow. Originally, the team had integrated this technology in a way where workflows were these strange XAML things, and you had their own name and their own discovery mechanism, etc., and that did not survive the first review. There were some bloody noses and some cracked ribs, and then we have this model, because I know you don't have time to keep learning new stuff, and so the stuff that you've learned is just going to work against modules. You discover them, they're against workflows. You're going to discover them the same way. You're going to invoke them the same way, get help on them the same way. Everything's the same. Now, I mentioned this remoting. Remember, remoting, as an admin, I could connect to this machine. Everything's great. As a guest, I could connect to that machine if I was given access to, but I ran as myself, and therefore there were some things I could do and things I couldn't do. Wouldn't it be great if I said, hey, I'm going to let this regular low-privileged user connect, and when they connect, I want them to run as an administrator for these functions only. And you can now do that in V3. So we have this thing called a run as credential. And so when I register that, it's asking for what credentials do you want to run when someone connects here? And I give mine, and it says, warning, that's a dangerous thing to do.
Yeah, make sure you only have the commands you really want somebody to run here.
Yes, very important. MSP user, remember, a guest, you know, no privilege. I then use that, get those credentials. And now I connect to that configuration test run as, that's the new name I used. Access denied. What did I do? I forgot to give execute permissions. Thank you very much. I love this. Community. It takes community to succeed. Set PS session configuration test run as. I'm going to show. Security descriptor. Do you guys know about this one? There you go. So now we run this. Yay. And I do this. See, it's a small set of things. And here, most interestingly, I run this get me. And notice it says, you're connected as MSP user. as MSP user, but you run as user ntdev jsnover. And so now when I do get service before MSP user does not have the privileges to do this, but jsnover does. And so that is delegated administration. There's a ton more with PowerShell version 3. We gave you a kind of a hint of it here. We're here after the talk. We can talk some more. And then, of course, later on in the year at TechEd and such, we'll be flooding you with tons of sessions on this stuff. So PowerShell version 3 is available today in the beta of Windows 8 and Windows Server 2012. And it's available down level through something called the Windows Management Framework 3.0.
Mm-hmm. On Server 2008 R2, 2008, and Windows 7.
Yeah. So thank you very much for your time. We have time for a few questions up here, but thank you.